The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Good morning, everyone. You're listening to Campus Voices. I'm Ryan Thornton.
I'm Nicole Parr.
And today we're talking to Professor Lindsay Naylor from the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment and the Department of Geography. She's recently done research on food sovereignty in Spain, coffee farming in Mexico, and urban geography, and she describes herself as a food geographer.
What is a food geographer?
Well, that's an excellent question. It's one of the ways that I describe myself in my work because I'm really interested in, as a geographer, understanding and explaining difference. And for me, that leads me into a lot of places where there's inequality and power imbalances. And the way that I like to ask questions about those imbalances is through food. And so I'm looking at difference across space, geography, through the lens of food.
What exactly do you mean? Because I know you've said this before, that your lens is through food and agriculture. Mm-hmm. How do you apply that to like your research?
That's a great question. I apply it by asking bigger questions and using food to explain things that are happening. So, for example, in my research with fair trade coffee farmers, I was really interested in how farmers were using a combination of agricultural activities to maintain autonomy from the state. So how is it that they were producing coffee for the fair trade marketplace and producing corn for their own subsistence? And what about those farming practices really allowed them to have a different sort of power relationship with both the market and the state? And so if my questions are about that kind of power relationship, food is just an entry point to begin to think about how those relations play out over space.
All right. So you've done a lot of research on coffee. We recently saw you talk about the fair trade label itself.
Yes.
What are some of these myths about the fair trade label?
Oh, that's great. I'm just really excited about the questions you're asking because they're really fun to think about. The myths about the fair trade label are that I would describe might be different than the myths that the fair trade labelers would describe. And so if you did a Google search for that right now, you might find something a little different than what I'm going to say. I would say that there's one really big myth around fair trade labels, and it's that they're all the same, right? And that to participate in the fair trade consumer producer exchange, all you have to do is look for that label and you're having the sort of same experience no matter which one you buy. And why that's a myth is that they're all actually rather different, and they, while maintaining similar goals for producer empowerment and development and sustainable growth, they go about that in very different ways.
So if you're a consumer and you want to be a conscious consumer, mm-hmm. Is there a label that you should look for that is different than the fair trade label? Or
yes, no. So I get asked that question quite a lot because here we have all of these things that are supposed to be helping us make really good decisions. And we want to feel like we are making really good decisions. And so for me to come in and say, well, the decisions that you're making are maybe based in sort of the ideas that you have about this particular thing. People say, well, then what should I buy? You know, what should I look for? And I think that my version of conscious consumerism might be different than your version of conscious consumerism might be different than your version. And so what I've encouraged people to do, and you heard me say this at Science Cafe, is to really think about the interaction that they want to have with the marketplace. And so some people might be more interested in protecting bird habitat, and so they would look for a label that focuses explicitly on that. Some people might be really interested in supporting small-scale, democratically organized, shade-grown coffee farms and farmers. And so that's a different label. Some might be interested in supporting labor and the ability to unionize and to receive a fair wage. And so that's a different label. And some of the labels do a lot of these things at the same time. The thing that I seek to point out is that we can't expect them to all be the same. And so we really have to do more to educate ourselves about why they're different.
So would you say that fair trade is just marketing?
Oh, that would be, I think that would be a little unfair on on the folks that are participating in it. So a few years back, gosh, almost 6 years now, the two biggest third-party certifiers broke apart, Fair Trade International and Fair Trade USA, which were called other things before that. But when that happened, it caused a huge sort of reflective moment among the people that were participating in Fair Trade. And one of the coffee roasters that I work with said, "Fair Trade is dead. Long live Fair Trade." And so I think that it has been a very important marketing tool for particular groups. Starbucks uses it very well.
Right.
They don't buy all of their coffee fair trade, but they do buy a lot of coffee fair trade. It's been a really important way of shedding light on the fact that there are disproportionate exchanges happening, right? The people that are producing the things that we're consuming as luxury items for the most part, because if you think about what fair trade items are, they tend to be things like coffee and chocolate and tea and mangoes, things that are not necessarily, although I imagine many people would say that coffee is a necessary thing in their lives. But it's still a luxury crop that doesn't grow in a large part where it's consumed. But it has also been important for exposing the imbalances in a free trade system. So yes, it's a marketing tool. It's helped to expose some things. And it also has brought sort of different ideas about community and development and trade and business into places that were struggling for market access. And it has made a difference in some people's lives. Like, I know that I'm launching a critique of fair trade, but it's important to remember that it has made possible people's ability to, for example, buy medicines or send their kids to school. Or to put in a clean water well, right? Those are things that can't be overlooked. There has been a substantial impact through fair trade programming.
Right. So something I know you have said before is that fair trade can encourage theft.
Oh, yeah.
What exactly did you mean by that?
So in the communities that are producing for fair trade, not everybody who is a community member is necessarily part of that production process. So in my experience and others who are researching fair trade have found this too, is that some of those improvements that are brought into the community through the influx of fair trade premiums or through certain development projects, they tend to be sites of theft. So in one of the communities that I worked in, they had used some of the money that they pooled together through their cooperative to buy equipment, individual equipment for each farmer as part of the processing of the coffee. And a lot of those were stolen out of their backyards by non-members of the cooperative. So those kinds of improvements tend to be, yeah, sites of theft. And I wouldn't say encourages theft necessarily, or maybe I did say that, but it certainly creates a tension between people who are participating in the fair trade marketplace and are able to reap some of these benefits and those who are closed out of the fair trade marketplace or otherwise not participating but want to also reap those benefits. Because one of the things that I always say in all of my classes is that we live in a system that puts profit before people, and that thinking about that and thinking about how we want to interact with other people is really important to thinking about economic exchange. And so, yeah, I'm suggesting that maybe we should think about creating a system that puts people before profit, and that's, you know, pretty unpopular.
We're talking to Lindsay Naylor from the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment and the Department of Geography. She is a self-described food geographer. Lindsay, you do a lot of research on these farmers, mm-hmm. and lots of them are what we would call resistance farmers. They're resisting government. In what way are they doing that?
So the folks that I work with in Chiapas, the farmers that I do research with, are self-declared in resistance. There's a long history that would overrun your program and possibly take it over for the next few years if I described it in 30-minute bits. But what is important, sort of highlights of that, are that indigenous peoples in Mexico have been fighting a very, very long time for recognition and for their existence, for their right to exist. and to be Indigenous peoples. And the folks I work with, among others, call it the 500-year war, right? Since 1492, right? And this is a really important piece of their resistance. And in southern Mexico in 1994, there was an uprising of Indigenous peoples to gain recognition from the state. And there's a whole other history that's attached to that in terms of trying to get rights to self-determination and autonomy. And the government wasn't willing to cede that autonomy in the way that it was discussed with the Indigenous people. And so they made a declaration of autonomy without the government. And so the resistance that they're practicing is that resistance of autonomy and resisting state efforts to incentivize them away from building autonomy and to resist military threat and paramilitary threat because there's a lot of violence in these communities. Just after my last visit there, someone was murdered that was participating in building a school in an autonomous area. And I wish that I could say that was uncommon. There is a lot of violence against people who are trying to build for themselves a better world, and that that world doesn't fit the image of sort of a NAFTA, quote unquote, modern Mexico, is what they sort of are fighting for.
Is there an end in sight? Can they beat the government, or is this going to be another 500 years?
So I would say that as a researcher, I don't put on my diagnosis hat and say they've achieved, their struggle. The folks that I work with are Tzotzil Maya, and the word for resistance, the words that are used to describe resistance in Tzotzil, I learned, are Tzikilvokol, which means to withstand suffering. So I would say that if there is a light at the end of the tunnel for them, it might actually be the train. And so it is a long struggle to try to build these worlds, and it is a slow and patient one. And where it may have been violent in the 1994 uprising, it is now very peaceful and is based in a pacifist resistance of hope and possibility. It is not up to me to say whether or not they can win this fight. I think that there is significant structural oppression against Indigenous peoples in Mexico and against people of color worldwide. You know, you can look beyond Mexico and to the to the borders and to the situation of refugees worldwide to see that there's a significant problem with how we view people that are not of European descent. And so I think that, yeah, there's a very long struggle ahead for people. You should come take my class in food geography.
I think I'll have to.
We start
that.
Global and we go local. I teach economic geography and uneven development. And because I think talking about the structural oppression that's basically by design through the capitalist system, like capitalism is designed to accumulate by dispossessing. The last third of the term I teach Take Back the Economy, which is about putting into practice a politics of hope and possibility. And by thinking through all kinds of different economic exchange that happen. So it's not just you working for a wage in a capitalist marketplace so that you can buy a house, so that you can, have 2.5 children and contribute to the taxes and contribute your taxes, but that there's a range of different kinds of exchanges that happen that are beyond that. And that gives me a space for hope that there are these other exchanges. And I think that's what's happening in southern Mexico.
You talked about how lots of these fair trade regulations mm-hmm. are just displacing the workers. Lots of the kids just go into the cornfields instead of the coffee.
Yeah, so that one I think is really hard to hear, because taken out of context, it sounds like I'm saying, and child labor, right? But we can think about it in a couple of ways. There is abusive child labor and slave labor that happens in our food and agricultural system. The vast majority of cocoa production is produced by enslaved child labor, right? So sorry about the chocolate, folks. But the existence of farmers predicated on subsistence really means that it's a family operation, right? So, and that's not something that we even batted an eyelash at when we set up a school system in the United States that was surrounded or that was built on the idea that kids would help with the harvest, right? So if we think about it more that way, it really shows that there's a disconnect between the standards that are set up for production and fair trade and sort of how people live their day-to-day lives. And so in order to be compliant with fair trade regulation, kids are not working in the coffee fields, but they're still working in the cornfields. And in fact, they're working more in the cornfields mm-hmm. because their parents can't help. So the standard that's meant to protect them may actually end up changing sort of that relation to work and to labor. And one of the things that I write about is that, and others, Sarah Lyon in particular, who's done some really excellent work on fair trade coffee in Oaxaca, or not Oaxaca, I'm sorry, in Guatemala, she and I have both talked about how these standards are universal, right? They come from organizations in Europe and the United States, and we have a particular idea, like child labor sounds like a bad thing, right? We want to stop that. Like, we expect that children should have the opportunity to thrive and to go to school and to play and to be kids. And so, like, our idea of taking child labor out of coffee fields is not necessarily, you know, based in this situation I've just described, but it isn't based in farmers' realities. And so we have these universal ideas that we're trying to apply to very different situations, geography, right? And so that's why I brought that up when talking about sort of this mismatch in the standards and in the regulations for fair trade. And that's not because someone's in a boardroom going, we're going to stop all the children from working and make it so that, you know, they can't produce corn. I think it's because there's a real lack of attention to place, right? And, you know, you've got a geographer on the line here. So I think that that's really important and something that needs to be done if we're going to think about how standards can be used to actually improve the livelihoods that people are trying to practice, not the ones that we envision for them.
So we are talking to Professor Lindsay Naylor from the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment in the Department of Geography. She describes herself as a food geographer. Lindsay, would you like to tell us about your work in the local Philly area regarding the addition of fruit trees in an urban area?
Yeah, so this work is also really exciting and very different than the work that I did in Mexico and the work that I'm doing in Cuba and Spain. I am new to the East Coast as a researcher, so most of my work before was done in Oregon. And so it's really exciting to be able to just pip up the road to Philadelphia and talk with the Philadelphia Orchard Project, who is part of a growing group of folks in the United States who are trying to increase public fruit access through the planting of fruit bearing trees. And so, and the Philly Orchard Project does it a little bit differently than like Fallen Fruit in Los Angeles, for example. But there are fruit forests, oh gosh, pun, sprouting up everywhere. In the United States, Seattle has the Beacon Food Forest. There's the Boston Tree Party, and there are initiatives all over the United States. And I was really interested in looking at the initiative in Philadelphia because Philadelphia has started their sustainability initiative called the Greenworks Project. And there are two parts of the Greenworks Project that really speak to this research. And one is to increase tree cover in Philadelphia. And the other is to increase food access to people who might not be getting fresh food. And so the question, you know, about this research is, you know, if we plant fruit trees in public space, or if we make available or make people aware of public fruit and nut production that is already existing in the city, does that really change people's food access? And so it's research I'm just starting, and I'm doing this work with, so it's an urban geography project, and Dr. Paul Jackson, also in the Department of Geography, is working on this project, particularly looking at issues of gentrification around greening space. And then Dr. Del Levia is going to be looking at the ecological benefits of these trees and taking soil samples and looking at how the fruit content does in an urban environment, you know, because we think about urban environments and we tend to disassociate them from food production. And some of that is because of urban pollutants, like things that might be in the soil, things that might be in the air. And so we're going to study that too. So it's a really fun project that's just starting. And I'm sure people are like, oh, she's not all doom and gloom. but it's nice to be doing something in our backyard, as it were.
You called it an urban food forest. Is that just planting fruit? What is that?
That's good. So there's a long-standing practice of agroforestry across the globe, and it tends to be rural. It tends to be concerned with creating systems of subsistence and small-scale commodity farming that intercrop annual plants, you know, things that we would grow like tomatoes and potatoes and things that just grow, you know, on a seasonal basis with perennial crops. So bushes and vines and trees that are fruit or nut producing. And so that practice has been around for a really long time all over the globe. It's only recently that we started to cite that practice in urban areas and as intentional sort of sites of food production. And so there's a sort of growing terminology that's being used, calling these places urban food forests. Does that get it?
Yeah. What about urban areas makes them really need these food forests?
Oh, so I don't know that they really need these food forests. I think food forests are an interesting way to scratch an issue that needs a number of diverse and attentive strategies for thinking about food access. Food access is disproportionate, right? Some people have more than others. Some people have better physical or monetary access to food. And a lot of urban research around food recently has been about not so much the city as a site of food production, but the city and urban areas more broadly as places where it's difficult to access food for particular groups. And we talk about that in different ways. We might talk about it as areas that are food deserts. And so that's a term that we use to describe areas that lack access to fresh food. And then more recently, we've started to talk about food swamps, because not only are these areas, and those may map on to each other, because not only do those areas lack, you know, fresh kind of grocery store access or fresh food and grocery store access, they are inundated, so swamped, with hyper-processed foods. So we see a lot more convenience stores and fast food and things that are really good for getting calories into people, but not so good for getting nutrition into people. And so that's one of the ways that we talk about urban food. And so to think about the city as a site of production is something that we've done for a long time. And in fact, urban food production has been happening since there's been urban areas. But we've done it for different reasons over time. So, and I could talk a lot about that. What's one of my very first research projects was looking at food production in the city and sort of the history of that and why we kind of bristle at when people pull up their lawns and put in food. What is it about removing that invasive species, the lawn, and putting in native, you know, fruits and vegetables that is so, like, kind of grates against our ideas of what that space should look like.
I know you said you also studied food waste issues, right?
So it's not part of my research program, but mm-hmm. It is part of my teaching. So I always address food waste in my my food geographies and food justice class, which is every spring.
Side note.
Coming up. I love that class because we get to tackle things that are happening. And again, I do it from a global perspective to a local perspective, because I think you need to have a big picture of what sort of a global industrial agricultural system looks like. And we have this imaginary of it. But there's also a lot of production that's happening that doesn't really fit into that imaginary. And because of the way that we've built our food systems, there's also a lot of waste that comes from it. And so we get to talk about the different sites of waste, because there's domestic, right? You know, you're like, oh, I didn't finish my dinner tonight, and it goes in the garbage. And then there's retail, and then we can think about losses on the farm. And there are different things that perpetuate that. And some of it has to do with commodity pricing, and some of it has to do with disease, and some of it has to do with lack of knowledge about processing, or, you know, oh, the refrigerator died, you know, and so we have to dump all of this. And so we talk about those things, and then we also talk about them on campus, too. And I am not the expert on campus. There are people who do this. The Office of Sustainability is addressing this on campus in a number of different ways, which I think are really great. And so some of my students get to look into that, and we talk about it. But yeah, food waste is an important issue, and I think it's becoming a lot bigger part of the public consciousness. Like, last time I was here, we talked about ugly fruit, right? Because those things that don't look right get tossed. And now there's this huge movement to get people to buy the tomato that has, like, a little pokey nose coming out of it, or the apple that looks like it's smiling at you. And that's an important piece of it. And it's also moved on to the municipal level. So at least on the West Coast, I've seen major ag campaigns to get people to compost. And they're putting out, you know, we have our garbage and our recycling. Well, they also have a compost bin now, and it goes to municipal composting. And in Seattle, you can be shamed for not putting your stuff in the right place. They will put a bright pink sticker on your compost or on your garbage saying, hey, there was stuff in here that could have been composted. So all your neighbors know. Right? There's this whole process of education and shaming about what can be reused.
So on the topic of ugly fruit, I know you said once that grocery stores actually influence our bodies based on how they're set up.
Oh, yeah.
What exactly did you mean by that?
In a number of different ways, grocery stores influence how we shop and what we eat. And I think we were talking about in the context of shelf share, because, for example, corporations can buy their spacing on the shelf to sort of put themselves in the space that you're most likely to see. And things that are marketed to younger people might be lower. And
I didn't know that.
And really just the way that the grocery store is set up, like everything in the aisle is packaged, right?
Right.
And everything around us is fresh. And nutritionist Marian Nessel writes about this. She writes about how we should just shop the outside of the grocery store. But there are always things that pull us in to the center. And so that really, it does influence kind of how we shop and what we buy. And increasingly, just learned about this, the shelves, talkers, like the things that are advertising to us to, you know, with maybe coupons that are becoming digitized. If you have the app for that particular brand, like the retailer that you're shopping at, for example, Whole Foods, which is doing this, they will send you a message on your phone with a coupon maybe, or incentivizing you to buy something that you just walked past in the store because they know you're there.
That's borderline creepy.
Right? And maybe you're not explaining it the best, but I just learned about this the other day that if you have the app for the store that you're shopping in, it will recognize that you're in the store and it will push notifications to you of things that you can buy while you're in the store. So there's a lot of different ways that the grocery store influences us, but mostly it's the setup. And other people have written about that more. But yes, the answer is yes.
We've been talking to Lindsay Naylor from the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment and the Department of Geography. You're writing a book right now, right?
I am writing a book.
What's that all about?
It's really exciting, and it is focused on the stuff that we were talking about with the fair trade coffee farmers, and it is still in progress. So that's why it's that's why I sound like this. Ask me in a few months, I might be less excited. But really, I'm focusing on the question of economic development and how to live well, and the idea that through creating these production consumption exchanges in fair trade, that we're very dangerously moving towards telling people how they should live through that they should be coffee producers, that in order for them to be fair trade coffee producers, they have to be impoverished, that there has to be someone that's disadvantaged in order for us to consume a certified product. And so in my book, I'm addressing that. And the reason, well, there's a number of reasons for that. But one of the things that has led me to have that particular conversation is because the farmers I work with want to maintain a subsistence lifestyle. They identify first and foremost as corn farmers, and they use the fair trade marketplace to help them maintain that existence. And what they want is to live dignified livelihoods in a way that they've set out for themselves, and to not be part of a development project that's coming from above. And so that is one of the main themes of the book.
Thank you so much for talking to us, Lindsay. We really hope you can come back again. This is all really interesting. And if there's somebody out there who's listening to this and feels like they want to do something, where would you steer them to?
About what?
All of it.
All of it.
The internet.
About all of it.
There are a lot of really excellent resources. For people that are interested in learning more about the fair trade movement, because I think certification is really wrapped up in the fair trade market, I would have them look at the Fair World Project. They're doing a lot of really good education and information. And if you're interested in the Philadelphia Orchard Project, you can follow them on Twitter and Facebook and go to any of their really fabulous tree planting sessions. They do jam making sessions. And yeah, go get involved up there. It's really excellent stuff. And really just think about how you want to interact with the food system and find out how you can do it that way.
Lindsay Naylor, food geographer, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. I'll be back in 2 years.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.